Hi everyone, welcome to the Data Protection Made Easy podcast. Today is the season 2 episode 12 and we just came back from Easter break. How are you doing, Kane?
I'm great, thank you. Kate, how are you?
I'm all right. We had an absolutely great session today about weaponized SaaS. What do you think about the session?
I always love talking about SaaS with the community because obviously I feel like it's something that they're particularly passionate about. Like I'm particularly passionate about it. So I feel like it's always great to sit there and have a conversation. I mean, it was one of our busier sessions of the year so far. But I always really enjoy talking about SaaS and especially the turn that SaaS has taken within the recent sort of couple of months in relation to sort of AI and the use of that from data subjects. So yeah, I thought it was a great session.
Yeah, it was really nice. I think it was really interesting to see as well, like the amount of challenges that people are facing currently to actually deal with this SaaS, particularly now with the merging of the AI and all these technologies, and that now they think they are the advisors of the data subject. And we explore a little bit as well the role of the ICO when dealing with these SaaS and potentially complaints that will come from data subjects, but we'll not give that much away. I hope you have a nice session and happy Friday.
Enjoy.
Very succinct.
That was good, wasn't it? And then we can jump right into the session. So we got another great session. And one of my favourite topics, to a sense. I know it's probably one that causes quite a lot of pain to people, but it is real good to have the conversation around it, isn't it? And we're talking today about weaponized SaaS, or the fact that SaaS are now feeling something that is more weaponized.
Yes.
How do you feel about that statement in itself, Kate? As a SaaS being weaponized, like the use of that phrase.
I think unfortunately it's becoming more regular, and is definitely something that we are all the organizations are seeing in a very regular basis and super often. Unfortunately, again, I feel that I'm repeating myself when I use this word, but it's a dilemma because, again, we do have a right as an individual to right to access something and the personal data that an organization held by yourself. But on the other side of coins, we have seen that SaaS is just being used constantly in to overwhelm the organization, normally correlated and linked to any potential action that comes to court, any complaints that will go through, any satisfaction from the employee or ex-employee or client and anything like that. And as well comes alongside with super massive advice that will come from solicitors as well. I'm sure that you've seen this a lot, is people are becoming more aware, and I'm super aware of it, and I'm happy in a way, but they are relying a lot in ChatGPTs and any other AI platforms to kind of come to access to this right to access. And the ChatGPT definitely says, well, if you want to do this, regardless what you do, SaaS is something that you should always submit.
Seems to be the driving force, doesn't it? AI seems to be where this resurgence or further sort of informing of rights have appeared from. It's interesting in the main, because I do wonder how this has kind of like spanned off the basis. I wonder what questions have kind of triggered it to then lead down the aspect of SaaS, because it's definitely something that has happened. I think it's very clear to any, I'm sure practically everybody within the meeting today has probably received some kind of rights request recently that looks very much like it's come from one of our pals in the old AI platforms, whether it's Copilot or ChatGPT, whichever. All the same kind of rhyme and reason, the same kind of floaty requests. And I guess there's more of an element of a culture in some sectors these days. And I think Hannah kind of summarizes a little bit onto what my point is leading on to, which is that as a housing association tends to implicate that people that are, you know, maybe serial complainers or people that are maybe particularly difficult or maybe are pushing for a particular thing really like to lean into the realm of information rights as like a almost a little bit of a sucker punch, for sort of lack of a better phrase, to kind of reinforce whatever their current issue is. It always seems to span, obviously, around a point in time, which makes sense logically, doesn't it? But it seems to be presenting a problem to organizations at the moment.
Yeah, I think definitely with housing associations is where we are seeing this more often. Coming definitely the SARs in their own being weaponized, yes or no, but normally linked to these repair claims and anything complaints-wise. And it's more in a sense to trying to disrupt or trying to find, as Anna is mentioning, like information that does not exist, or trying to understand exactly where was the type of decision making and the rationale behind some sort of decision that definitely made the data subject in this case very unsatisfied for whatever reason. And one thing that just unsettles me is normally when these requests actually come from solicitors. So it's not just the data subjects, actually. They are weaponizing their own kind of rights, I would say, because with the intention. And I want to just probably go and try to understand what this weaponized means, because is that needs to be an intention, a kind of a malicious intention at the very least, around it, like to probably harass someone. Already happened. I'm dealing with one currently to harass one of the staff members, because one of the clients that my client that I was visiting this week was very unsatisfied with when a complaint that went to the complaints department. And they then were advised to submit a subject access request, and the tone is to definitely to harass the staff members and to make that as a mon.
And that came from a solicitor. I feel about solicitors in the realm of data protection, because I know, as you know, I reckon we probably have a fair few house and associations here today that probably knew exactly what it was like. I know it's changed for a lot of people now with their kind of responses to it, but how heavy-handed SARs were floated about in disrepair claims and elements in relation to obviously housing and other elements like that. It was really quite intense, I think, for that period in time, until organizations can kind of started, you know, put their foot down a little bit and started batting down and batting away these a little bit more. But solicitors were proven to be very, very heavy-handed in their application of SAR, and very scaremongery. It was very much, you know, you give this or we go to court and we get this, or, you know, you have to give this because of X and Y and Z, and trying to really, you know, put a bit of fear in the organization in relation to, and that seems a little bit like that, you know, intentionally and tactfully trying to be disruptive and to make the organization feel a kind of way.
Yeah.
To almost force them to maybe show their hand or to make a decision. Or I think Michael was referencing a smoking gun, which is that, you know, the smoking gun always feels like it's the big one, isn't it, for SARs, it feels, especially if we look in the realms of what is internal a lot of the time, a lot of internal, whether that's employee, ex-employee, it's always looking for the smoking gun that either never exists or that they're never going to find, because they're not actually entitled to that information. But I think you're right. I think you make a really keen point about the solicitor stuff, not to categorize them broadly, but
no, I think it's a good point, and is something that is important to mention here, and obviously to understand from the audience if obviously they had any kind of similar challenges and how do they deal with them, because I think it's important to kind of share obviously our input and feedback. But I, on this case, I feel that the solicitors have the role that people automatically, as soon as the solicitor is involved, automatically creates a danger, a scary fear kind of moment or environment. And that's definitely the intention behind when the solicitor normally is representing data subject and reacting with this tone, with this, as the right was absolute, as the right, they had absolutely the right to request all the information, regardless where, if it's personal data, yes or no. The second thing is, I think this is being used as a potential like a litigation tactic to trying to understand exactly what it is, like a phishing before any legal proceeding, like it going and goes on. And as well to understand what will be the strategic to go and before the legal proceedings to go through. But another point I would like to make is in the chat is that there are loads of people, and it's really funny actually, because it happened as well with us quite often, not me, with myself, but the other consultants, where there was we were representing a client about a data subject, submitting a site, etc. And we were arguing with the data subject because the AI platform that he was using to advise them on the SAR, he was giving wrong advice. So he was basing himself, oh, but actually ChatGPT didn't say that. So actually he's wrong.
It's crazy, isn't it? I frequently have what feels like actual arguments with AI about its application of the law. And I think it is, I think, staggeringly foolish sometimes to rely on it from that perspective and to stay so firm to your sort of argument.
Yeah.
You know, I appreciate some people see it as this amazing tool that tells you everything you need to know. And it can be with the right kind of prompt, with the right kind of sort of building into it. But data subjects these days, more than ever, whether that's because maybe they reuse ChatGPT for their responses to justify themselves, seem like hell-bent on finding every element of the law, every act that has been breached. I've seen case law referenced in some cases where it wasn't even about data protection law. It was...
It's not even confirmed what they're saying.
You know, I'm only asking to clarify the scope of this art, because I think that is a big problem actually with the requests of these nature is they're all so sweepingly broad. And when it comes to actually trying to have a conversation with this person to understand the request, because a lot of the times we're not actually going to be able to fulfill this request in the way that we want, then we go back and they don't understand what they want because they're fueled by something that isn't their own intention. And then where do you go from there? Because they're not going to move from, we want to do it all, and you don't want to do it all because you don't think it's reasonable and proportionate. You want to clarify the search, which you well within your rights to do.
It
puts you in a bit of a sticky situation, doesn't it? And then you've got to figure out internally what is reasonable and proportionate, and then be prepared for the backlash effectively that will come from the data subjects. It's very rare these days I see a SAR go through, no matter how well it was done, that doesn't have some kind of response from the data subjects that is negative effectively.
I think you are touching a very good point that I go... And I always, when I'm talking about individual rights, particularly with SARs, because obviously is it the right that normally is more exercised and the organizations deal with like on a regular basis, that is intention. We need to understand every single time we are dealing with the rights or somewhat data subjects actually exercising the rights is to understand what is the intention behind the exercise or that right, particularly when there is a subject access request, particularly when there is a context or a historic relationship between the controller, in this case, the organization and the holder of their personal data and the data subject. And I mean clients, external third parties, ex-employees, current employees, if there is a grievance, if it's not. So trying to understand exactly the context and always bearing in mind that there is no right or wrong way to respond to this in a way that there is no clear way to respond to these type of requests. As you are mentioning, we need to figure it out what is reasonable and proportionate. We need to understand exactly what type of information we need to gather and in what extent, etc. So I think it's very important to make the point that all of this is based on communication. So if you do set a tone of, okay, we are here to obviously to respect your rights, you do have a right, but we as well have our rights and obligations as on an accusation, and we can do only what we can do, and we have some tools and mechanisms to protect ourselves as well. So let's figure it out what actually we can do with your SAR, because we don't want to refuse your rights and your request, but as you can imagine, that is absolutely out of order. So when you ask for all our data, I want all my personal data from the last 20 years, I think it's very reasonable to assume that this is too much. And I think now is the point that you would like that we're talking about before, that is, what is this manifestly unfounded and excessive? Because I think it's something that the organizations can rely on, is something that is a tool and a mechanism, but sometimes is over reliable.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is hard. I think it's really hard. I think you've got to deal with multiple things when dealing with SARS that are weaponized in this light. You've got to deal with quite frankly the very frequent, basically, arguments that you may have to have with these individuals who remain dissatisfied with your SAR, but not dissatisfied enough to go to the Information Commissioner, apparently.
Yeah.
And you get stuck in this limbo where you feel like you have to keep responding to this individual, or they try to pressure you to. And, you know, I always advise the customer to stay strong on, you know, two, maybe max strong bits of correspondence back to the data subject before fully explain your justification. And then when you do it, hopefully, if they continue, you've got to point them to the ICO. You know, the ICO has to act as your friend in that regard. You find that they won't go to the ICO because they probably know that they're just kind of trying to strong arm you into a decision. And to be honest, let's be frank, if they do go to the ICO, then you'll probably hear from it next year. So, you know, they'll get to you eventually, or maybe they won't at all with the new sort of high-risk approach that they're taking for the requests. And maybe that's why people don't go to the ICO. Maybe that's part of the problem. I don't know. But I can't imagine they are very privy to that level of information. But no, I agree with you, Carl. It's hard to know whether the ICO has actually received a complaint unless they're actively getting in touch with you about that complaint. It is, you know, I think the ICO at the moment is an impossible beast for complaints management. You know, you could wake up one day, you know, bless your heart, come into work, sit down and have 40 emails from the ICO, but you don't know, or you might never.
We have the complaints now to go to the controllers instead of the ICO. They are trying to release some burden.
Well, they're doing the best they can. Yes. But it's not going to. I was trying to have this conversation the other day. I actually don't think that stops anything. I think if people want to go to the ICO anyway, they're going to go to the ICO anyway. The ICO is still going to do what they've done prior, which is have you spoken to the data controller? And I think it's going to remain like that, you know, for a while. I don't see any kind of, I suppose, quick fix or any fix as of recent to actually solve the amount of sort of complaints handling that they're getting. I'm sure I've mentioned this before, but I remember just before Christmas, I got a few emails from the ICO about some breaches that I reported for some of our customers. Fairly, you know, average stuff, nothing that should have materialized into anything too inherently wrong, but we made the decision to report more on cautionary side. And they got back to me about eight, nine months later, just saying, we presume that you've taken mitigating actions. I was like, well, okay, great.
What does that mean?
Yeah, well,
give me more.
It really takes
Pfizer authority.
Takes away from their value, doesn't it? A little bit.
It does.
Which is maybe the problem. So obviously you've got to deal with the complaint element of it, and you've got to be succinct as possible whilst trying to basically, you know, ignore the complaint sort of jabbing as much as they can. And then you have the other element of actually looking to see if you can stop repeat requests, because there probably will be elements of these requests that then become layered, which obviously I know unfounded is a little bit difficult. But excessive can tend to be quite useful, especially considering the nature of them actually covers most of it. Their requests, as I say, are very broad.
Yeah.
So you could probably look to apply excessive in some cases, obviously never blanketly, but you're probably going to get to that point with a repeat offender where you can start looking to refuse. Again, that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to stop responding. But it does mean hopefully there's a little bit of a barrier there to stop you from basically redoing the same SAR over and over, you know, provide what is currently meaningful, if there is anything new to light. But understanding the heart of a data subject like that request is a bit tough, really. And it makes me a little bit sad that we don't have what the STAIRS have with the refusals, where it's like if they're, I think there's something in the STAIRS that say if they're like abusive in manner, or if they talk in like a rude tone, then you can refuse the request. And I was like, oh, that's quite an interesting like application, because it doesn't really work like that with manifestly unfounded. That's not its purpose, is it? It's not like, oh, you're being, you know, quite horrible, basically, so we're going to refuse it. It's effectively, we know that you have no real mean or heart to exercise this right.
Yeah.
So it's quite different and definitely very hard to prove, because how do you prove that someone doesn't want to make a SAR unless they kind of tell you? It really is quite difficult.
Yeah, I think that there is no intention, and there is the intention that definitely to cause some trouble and some harassment, definitely not to exercise their rights, would be very hard to argue. But I think could be, but I've never seen in actually. So I've seen some cases where the organizations actually apply this and it worked.
Okay.
So the data services did not come back with any response. And to be honest, if it works, it works. Because in the end of the day, we are here to defend ourselves as a controller and themselves as well as data subjects. But if based on the communication, if they accept it, well, we will be happy. Happy days, I think. I feel like, and I would like to go a little bit further on the one that I'm dealing with, because I think he's one of the most recent weaponized SARs that I'm dealing with, and is literally touching all of the topics that we are talking about here. So he's an ex-employee that there were disciplinary and new grievance and everything, unfortunately, wrong happened with his relationship with them and the control in this case. And he's asking for every single record that the organization has, both as their capacity as employee or ex-employee in this case, as well as a client or external in their personal capacity. He's asking for CCTVs, footage. He's asking for every single email communication that happened with any single staff member, regardless of their role and capacity. And there is, and unfortunately, when he left the organization, he left in a very bad terms. Mm. So we do already know that the context here and the story here, unfortunately, is not a positive one, it's a negative one. Things, unfortunately, happened the way that they didn't. Solicitors are already involved, and they are using the very rude tone and the tone of to kind of put scare the people that are managing these requests. And one thing that I actually mentioned within all the requests was, aside from the "I want all my records 20 years, regardless of my capacity, from every single staff member, I don't give you time frames because I actually this is my right. I'm exercising my right and I have the right to receive everything." He was saying that "I want a document." And we came back and said, well, you don't have the right to receive the documents per se. You do have the right to receive your personal data. That does not mean that you have the right to receive your documents. Mm. And they came back and said, that is wrong. That was not correct. That is wrong. Actually, my right is to receive the data in a format that was easy to understand and need to understand the context. Mm. And therefore, even the redaction, he was challenging the fact that we need to redact the context and the third parties, etc. Because what will be the use of this if they did not understand the context of things? And this is exactly what I'm trying to explain to you, is the subject access request only provides you with the right to access your own personal data, nothing more, nothing less. That's it. So that means that probably we can give back to you with a summary. We can give back to you with a line saying, well, we do have 3,000 emails where you only have the signature, where obviously is your personal data, nothing more. This is your kind of a copy and paste, like a screenshot of what actually looks like. We are not giving you 3,000 things of the same page. Mm-hmm. And that was it. So now he's being challenged. He does not accept actually as well the CCTV footage. The retention period comes to an end with after the 30 days. It's being deleted automatically.
Sure.
He said that as soon as the request came in, they should have automatically the CCTV footage should have been separated from the normal retention periods, for example. And well, as you, this is so much to handle. And I feel that it's kind of become more often. We already extended the deadline, but it's being a very hard one to manage.
Yeah, grievances are really hard, aren't they?
Yes.
I mean, we dealt up with them a lot on the support desk. I dealt with them a lot with my own customers. And I feel like they are becoming just as frequent as customer SARs now, if not more so in some people's cases. Obviously, grievances are less likely to occur than a customer being upset about something in the particular sector. But I think you definitely see more of them. And I think the individual going through it is because of the closeness to the organization and the understanding of the running of the business is really difficult. I mean, you've got to really sort of fine comb everything,
mm-hmm.
because you know in certain elements, irrespective of whether the personal data is, there's probably a lot of instances where you may be able to ascertain who these individuals are, and it puts you in a difficult spot. Obviously, yeah. The personal data is there. There's also the likelihood that they're going to identify a third party. So what do we do? I mean, mm-hmm. you can't blanket sort of redact, because again, where's the value? Context is still important for us, how you can provide it. If not, you know, there's no point. Just a name on a spreadsheet isn't going to do anything for them, really, is it? It's about being able to have the exactly. information to effectively not necessarily defend themselves, but to maybe prove that their information is being held mm-hmm. in relation to their rights and their freedoms, and then that's being upheld. So it's difficult. You've got to look through that. You've got to look if the balancing of it is worth disclosing. You've got two choices. You go to ask to consent, which, again, very unlikely that in most
never
cases.
Never saw happening. Never
yeah,
saw.
I've seen it happen. A lot of people
always
say no. I've seen a few people say yes. And then the organization has kind of backtracks on the decision. So again, kind of
actually,
like...
Actually, no, I don't want to anyway. Yeah.
I'm probably hoping that the individual was to say no and that gave them the justification. But I think especially when you tell data subjects in particular grievances that you've applied the first-party exemption, they seem particularly upset about it, which I think is an interesting thing, is that they ask for things like witness statements often, and obviously accounts of maybe individuals within their teams or other teams, and it's going to be really hard for them to get what they want. And again, they're looking for that smoking gun, as we were referencing at the start. But how are you ever going to find that in a case where it's kind of riddled with so much other third party data, basically?
I think, you know, in this is where potentially AI platforms and any ChatGPTs and any advice comes in the wrong way, actually. Because as we know, like, just direct identifying individuals can be indirect through opinions, comments, et cetera, et cetera. And that's definitely where the witness statements come in. Because even if you redact their names, they're talking about the individual themselves. And what ChatGPT comes back is actually, if they redact the names, because they don't care about the names, but if they redact the names, they actually have access to the rest of it because the personal data is about them. But that's incorrect, because even if you redact the names, but you do know who you're talking about and actually will cause a risk to the individual that made those, you need as well to protect them, and it's a balance. And again, it's just incorrect, and it's so dangerous when we do have chat AI platforms actually providing this advice, and as well is being followed by solicitors and anyone that is actually should be supporting the law, and is using this in argument just to kind of create this friction or potentially like this environment within the organization. So that's what I'm saying to all my customers and all of them that we are helping with the ASR process. That's why it's so important to have such a very relevant, practical SAR procedure in place. It's not to be like full of words that are empty. It needs to be practical. It needs to make sense, and it needs to be applicable to actually the reality of the organization. So when we do deal with templates, of course, they are such a good inspiration, but to be honest, they are completely pointless if they actually do not work. And I think it's when we are dealing with this, the important thing is, okay, we need to acknowledge, that's a fact, we need to acknowledge. In my acknowledgements, for example, I always make the point, okay, thank you so much for this. We are reviewing your request at the very moment. Please note your request will only include personal data, nothing more, nothing less. Important to make the decision, the distinction between what is business data, what is non-personal data, depending on what we are talking about. I normally give examples as well. If it's an employee bearing in mind that if it's not because you're part of a project, it actually is your personal data. Actually, that's business data. And if it's a tenant, I don't know, some reports in a sense, like if you want your mold report or your repairs report from a third party, that's again, is about the property, it's not about yourself.
Seems to be a lot of that.
Not be included.
I think.
And sometimes just they just leave it, you know, sometimes it works.
Sometimes,
spend there.
Or you continue to get
You're lucky.
You continue to get the same kind of stuff, if not.
Yeah.
I think you make an interesting point about, you know, the images of like, especially in relation to images and like property information and stuff like that, especially in the realms of social housing.
Yeah.
I think that one is floated around a lot. And in respect, similarly, when we're looking at internal SARs to like, or basically like all the work that they've done within the realm of them being there. And in the space of an employee, which I always found it was a really weird thing to request for. I've currently got a case that's going to tribunal for one of my customers that's in relation to something similar, where he wanted basically all the information of what he'd done in relation to sort of his sort of tasks and all the emails he sent. Obviously, that is difficult, because if they've been there for a while, you know, even a couple of years really adds up, doesn't it? And if they're unwilling to reduce the scope, then how do you try and do that? Obviously, you look at the search terms. Even things like their job role could potentially be problematic if other people have that kind of job role.
Mm-hmm.
Initials is always a hard one, because you know somebody like CG, CS might be easier to search for someone whose initials is NO or IS. You know, that's where that in particular is where the difficulty comes, especially where. And then because you can't look for the initials, then you've got to work off name, first name, full name. Again, how common is your name? That, again, can be difficult. I've seen so many cases where people get SARs from like something Smith, like a Mr. Smith.
Oh, John Smith.
Yeah, and they're a big organization. And they're like, we've got like three people in the business with the same name. And it's like, oh, okay, well, how do we actually go at searching that down? But internal SARs can be, you know, truly quite difficult. I think there's some of the more difficult SARs that organizations get. I think some sector specific ones can be particularly challenging. Mm-hmm. I always find the educational sector, undertaking SARs within the educational sector can be particularly difficult, especially if you're dealing with parents. Parents can be quite hard to deal with in some cases, especially where if the individuals are estranged, maybe if it's a father who has left the family and the mother has parental rights. You've got to act in the best interest of the child. Obviously, then the mother and the father again are all very complicated. So anybody in the educational sector, I very much kind of I emphasize with, because it's definitely a difficult task balancing that, especially when you're looking in the regards of sort of SENCO children and you're having to look at safeguarding reports and stuff. So I mean, it's definitely no easy task, and it's getting even harder now, because I think the only thing is that individuals will become more and more aware of the existence of a SAR. So, you know, I think the ICO needs to do more in the kind of guidance that's given to people. I mean, I can see in the chat that, and apologies for not being able to go through it all, because there's so much in there. But I can see in the chat that people are having some really interesting engagements with the ICO in terms of some of their responses to the SARs. And what would really help is if they took a little bit more time to get more detailed in the guidance that they're giving to SARs. SARs especially, because it's something that all organizations deal with to some respect, and a lot, nowadays a lot. The time constraint on debt protection teams, the DPOs, privacy officers is significant. So as the regulator, you would expect that they are able to be able to help in a more efficient way than they're doing, aren't they?
And,
currently it's, you know, it doesn't feel good enough. I feel like, especially now in light of the move to the way SARs are being used, the type of people making SARs, type of requests we're getting, I'm hoping to expect a little bit more from the ICO in terms of the guidance that they're giving. And if they give better guidance, people would go directly to them.
I think it's too broad. I think they just provide the guidance in such a broad terms and using this terminology that sometimes is even for us that we deal with this in a daily basis, sometimes it's hard to actually define what would that actually mean. And I appreciate that it's case by case assessments, but it's really hard. And as well as because by nature, in principle, there is likely to be an imbalance of power between already these data subjects and the controllers themselves. And therefore, the ICO normally tends to have a position of protecting these data subjects in first instance and kind of put it like a barrier between the organizations and not providing guidance to the organizations or focus to these organizations to help them actually. We want to protect the data subject, so here is our guidance to help you to actually provide with a good substance and response and how actually you deal with this. And it's sometimes a little frustrating, isn't it? Because definitely we understand the concept and we do understand exactly the intention. For example, about this manifesting and founded, we understand the excessive. I understand that sometimes we're saying, well, we are too busy, we have too much work to do, we have all of this, we have no staff to help us during our holiday. It's not an excuse, it's not a justification, but it's the reality. It happens. And I think that's exactly it that we are missing in here is we are full of this amazing legal jargon, words, complicated, broad terminology, but actually is lacking of actually practical examples. What should we do if this happens? Accepting weaponizing SaaS is a reality and is happening. And how should both, even both, because sometimes the data subjects, I appreciate it, can be unsatisfied with something and they're just trying their luck.
Yeah,
it's fine. They are just trying to luck and it's fine. It's like, okay, so we will accept this as a reality. So what does the organizations have to protect themselves? And on a data subject perspective, what should we expect on the organization side? Because it's just not enough. It's just not enough. You are told that you have we use the 28 days to respond that by say, it's not even working days, it's just the 28 days to in principle to do all of this. If it's not possible, we do have the expectation to extend the deadline, but therefore the onus is on you to justify why you are extending that deadline. The onus is on you to justify why it's unfounded or excessive, which I get it. But again, the data subjects, the controllers are not all monsters. The data subjects as well is sometimes use the law, and unfortunately they are told that they can use this in a way that can cause some burden to the organizations. And I feel here, unfortunately, that the organizations are missing out and they are being pressured because of this.
There's
some serious stress on organizations at the moment.
Yeah.
And it's really hard because in trying to extend those by saying you have Uber rights on, in trying to extend it for saying it's a lot of data, becomes a difficult task, actually. And it's not as simple as people think. And it feels really difficult to me because obviously you get a lot of people that make SaaS who just want to make them because they can. You get some people who genuinely want to make the SaaS and you've got to treat them all the same. Obviously, you've got to treat them all the same irrespective. The difficulty then comes into how do we actually manage this now, especially considering it may even increase more. A lot of people do SaaS individually, a lot of people, maybe there's one person in IT that does the search, maybe there's one person that deals and redacts the request, and that might not be as feasible anymore, and you don't want to be in the position where you're absolutely backlogged with SaaS and you feel like that's all you're doing, especially as a DPO where you have other tasks that are equally as important. And I suppose it's, I've got no real answer, unfortunately. I wish I did. I wish I could make it easy. I suppose there are always going to be solutions out there and maybe ways to make the amount of SaaS that you get, that's what, easier to deal with. Make sure you can very easily map out the flow of your SaaS. So how you search for information, work closely with the individuals within your team, have a good procedure that works to the business, that is keen to the business, and that someone can go in and that they can do. If just the search itself is going to be really stressful for you and you already feel like you're jumping through hoops, you're going to have a really difficult time, especially in very sensitive cases. Respond often, irrespective of what it is, respond often, keep them updated, let them know. Just because you find them really difficult to work with and correspond with, you know, you've got to push that all aside, and you've got to be your friendly selves as much as I'm sure you probably don't want to be.
Yeah.
But you've got to not be afraid to push back where you feel like things are getting too far as well. You know, don't feel like everything has to be, oh yes, that as quickly as I can, blah 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 blah, we'll get this started and then mm-hmm. the next. You know, you need to, you know, hopefully trust in the knowledge and the resources you have to know when a site is going too far, when it may be excessive, when exemptions have to be provided, and be strong in that approach and be clear in justifying that. You know, if you're going to apply an exemption, make sure that you have a real strong justification and that you feel confident that you could say that to that person. And that's really as far as you can go. Obviously, there's always going to be other options. You know, there are tools available to people. Obviously, it's out with searches. Of course, there are organizations that offer our services, like ourselves. Apologies for maybe a shameless plug there, but there are options that obviously can help teams who may struggle resource wise in helping their SARs more, especially in the need of people that may talk to. And fortunately, we have a very good community here on the Data Protection Made Easy podcast. So if you need people to hash it out over, I'm sure many of the lovely folks in here would be more than happy to talk you through anything that you feel like you're struggling with particularly. But yeah, unfortunately no easy answer. And the fix for weaponized SARs. But I will or we can as a community try and help you guys as much as possible.
Yeah, I think just to add exactly what you're saying and just to obviously finalize with this session, I think it's important as well to make sure that you clarify. Sorry, just having here. don't be scared to clarify the request. So if you do receive a request from a data subject and you do feel that you have, I want all my personal data, you do have the context, you do have the story, you do understand, and you can feel it, even if you don't know the person themselves, but you can feel the tone, you understand exactly who the intentions are. Ask for clarification of the request. Don't be scared of trying to understand a little bit more. Try to push back in a sense, well, we only provide the personal data. This is your right, is a personal data. It's not to the documents. It's not to the reports themselves. It's not the full document. Actually, it's just the personal data. So please do make that mentioned as well. It's very important to clarify. Have the strong procedure in a sense where the initials come as a situation to kind of look for, know exactly what you're doing, know exactly what type of response you should give. Like the initials is not automatically a refusal from a SAR, but to be honest, can be debatable if it's reasonable proportionate, considering obviously how big the organization is and how normal that these initials are, and as well the requests themselves. So with the initials, don't be scared to potentially challenge a little bit, understand a little bit more what they are looking for, because sometimes the response is quite straightforward. Sometimes they just want something that actually is not even on the data protection side, is actually with other department. They can go to the compliance, they can go to the governance and request themselves the policy or the internal rationale or the name of the senior manager that was involved with that. So they probably is not even part of the data protection matter. So to clarify your request. I feel that sometimes people just scared and feel that we need to comply with exactly what they are saying and we cannot push back. That's not correct. You have those tools with yourself, and just make sure that you are satisfied, and to finally just have a good and strong pack of templates alongside with your procedure. So if you do have some tools already prepared, such an acknowledgement request, such an extension of the deadlines, a refusal, a right refusal, etc., even if you don't are kind of completely aware, is already kind of half of the job done as well.
Yeah.
Don't forget to be trained.
No,
I think
absolutely.
It's always finalizing with the training. No, always trying to make sure that people know what we're talking about.
Just a few bits before, well, two very quick bits before we close off. Firstly, being obviously, I appreciate today was a very busy session. I think we peaked at about 170 people. What we will do is we'll go through some of the questions that have been left in the chat potentially unanswered today. If there's anything I feel like we can go through after the session, I'll just drop a quick message to anybody if we think there's anything that we think is valuable for a response like now. But instead, we'll be picking apart some of these requests and we'll be taking it away for a second session. Happy to retable this conversation. I know you're all pretty opinionated on this topic, which is fantastic. So if any of you want to get involved, just get in touch. We'd love to have you on, even for a brief little segment, if that's possible. And you know, if you guys are struggling with anything information rights related, feel free to either drop a message here or contact us, and one of us lovely folks can get in touch with you as well.
Thank you very much. Have a lovely Friday, everyone, and happy weekend.
Happy weekend.
Happy weekend.
Enjoy Fridays,
guys. Thank you very much. Take care.